thank you for having me here. And what my practice has been up till now is being a paper architect, in the sense that that we have done very few buildings, and the things that have built and are permanent are almost by accident. Not that we bemoan that fact, but it's not a thing where we've been commissioned to do buildings. So in that sense, you know, the idea that our practice is immaterial is something that resonates. But that's not to say, I think the revision for me would be that our practice isn't one that's resistant to building, or it's not one that's critical to practice, or one that wants to have a critical distance. In fact, I think what would distinguish us from the term is the idea that the ways that we are working that are immaterial have everything to do with an appreciation for practice, with an interest in what the future of our practice will be, and an investment in terms of what the role of practice is with respect to the market economy. And the particular part of the market economy that we're interested in is, for lack of a better word, the knowledge economy. And as we as a global society become much more information intensive, the question, I think, for architects is, what role does the physical world have in that? Is the physical world superseded by information exchange? Is it superseded by an economy of interaction between two people that deals just with information? Or is it superseded by an economy between companies or nations that are purely on an architectural level? Even to the extent where, you've heard architects use the word that we're in a post-geographical moment, that the geography means less now. And for me, I think the concern is that goes too far, that our idea is that that architecture is invaluable culturally because of the fact that it is physical, and moreover, that cities are a thing that impact knowledge economies, as well as a thing that are evolving now because of knowledge economies. And so with our practice, even though it's not largely based upon efforts to gain building commissions, our interest is in attempting to understand the position of architecture and to give value to the physical form of architecture as the general appreciation for the physical world is being renegotiated with what I'm calling the knowledge economy. So I do that through my practice, as well as through C-Lab, which, as Dagmar mentioned, is a research unit that I have at Columbia. And at Columbia, we're one-third of the editorial partnership of Volume Magazine. It also includes Arcus Foundation, which is based in Amsterdam, and AMO. And we have done a lot of various issues on different topics, including Doing Nothing, one where we constantly experiment with the format of the magazine. So this is one of the issues where the main book of this issue was not so big, but the supplement was like three times as big as the actual official magazine. We've done issues on leaks, so environmental leaks, the way that buildings leak, information leaks. We've done three on power, power at the scale smaller than a building, power at the scale of buildings, and then power at the scale of cities. We've looked at China. In 2006, we had a guest editor do an issue on the financial crisis. But in 2006, there wasn't a financial crisis. The financial crisis happened in like 2008. So people thought this was a joke, but we didn't. As Dagmar mentioned, agitation. We've looked at the Gulf. We did an issue on ambition, more on China, content development, et cetera. The latest one is on counterculture, American counterculture. And so what I'll talk about tonight is some of the work we do in my office, and then also some of the work that we do at C-Lab. And the idea is to have these two modes of working be visible to you as a thing that's an integrated practice. One, again, which I think has to do with activities that are architecture-based, but for lack of a better word, it's paper architecture. So one of the things that we're really interested in is just what kinds of mediums that we can use. And sometimes the mediums are very simple and very straightforward. This was a photography essay by a contributive ours, but I think the technique is very similar to kind of our method of working. This was a contribution by Neil Denari, and it's on sleeping in Tokyo. You've all heard that some cities, that all cities are so intensive in terms of the amount of stimulus that you have that there's an overload of information. But I think it's fair to say that Tokyo would be one place where there's so much information that you just have to take a nap at some point in the day, that you just have to kind of zone out for a little bit, or else there's just no way that you're going to make it through the day. So it's totally fine in Japanese culture to kind of doze off when you're in the subway. And so these are photos of the fact that it is a thing where, despite the fact that there are, 12 to 14 million people living there, that you can kind of just download for a moment go offline. So these are just photos of different kinds of modes of sleeping, the kind of group sleeping, individual sleeping, the kind of sleeping where that your personal belongings could be kind of left to the side of you without any fear of things being stolen. You can leave your backpack, your things on the ground, and that they somehow will be okay. And that everybody, sleeps. It's not just like businessmen or whatever, and it's not just that they're necessarily drunk. Neil, in this contribution, assures us that nobody in here is injured or dying or anything. But it is the case that if you do miss the subway closes at 12:30 in Tokyo, that you either have to pay for a capsule hotel or you might sleep on the street, and that you can sleep on the street and not be mugged. So other kinds of photography that we do, this is like kind of just taking photographs and manipulating them. This was for the power issue, and the power issue dealing with power at the level smaller than buildings. And this was about power dressing, how people dress. This was at the time the last 10 official Pritzker Prize photos. The point here being that the official dress code in architecture is casual, one necktie in 10 years. This is one that we did also for the power issue. It's on haircuts. This is the haircuts of the 50 standing senators at the time. It turns out that in Washington, there are only three haircutters that cut all the senators' hair. There's a very specific kind of look that you want to have, I guess, as a senator that that projects power. So this is just a very simple collection and clipping exercise. With this one, we want to evolve it into making a DIY power kit for ourselves. That are there potentially kinds of attributes, character attributes that you can project or associate with forms of dress, and could those attributes be recombined to be mobilized in a new personality that can intervene in geopolitical hotspots around the world? So, for example, that you could take separate attributes and combine them together, potentially to create a Saudi echo dictator that would broker peace in the Middle East. This was before the crisis, that you could have a person that would be a tribal populist real estate mogul who would understand the plights of middle Americans in terms of mortgages and land value. That you might have a Surgeon General of the U.S. that would believe in wellness. With the publications that we do all sorts of things. We do the official volume magazine, and then any chance we get, we do other kinds of publications. So friends of ours, Urban China, had an exhibition in New York, and we want to be a part of it, so we asked them if we could bootleg their magazine. So they were like, what? You're like, we're Chinese and you're not Chinese. Why are you bootlegging our magazine? But anyway, so we bootlegged their magazine, taking stuff from what they had printed, copying it, and then reproducing it here for a US audience. With this one, it was we did this right after the crisis. And one of the things we wanted to do was to look at how crises are portrayed. And that movies are really good at portraying crisis. There's always a moment of crisis within a movie. Much to our surprise, we always thought that the typically in disaster movies, right before the disaster occurs, that the sky turns gray. It's like a premonition that something disastrous will happen. But what we did was we looked through tons of movies and looked at the sky right before a crisis occurred within the narrative of the movie, and then just grouped them all together. So it turns out that disastrous skies are of all colors and of all spectrums, and that in doing this, you get juxtapositions of like Airport, Armageddon, and Babel in a kind of continuum of different disaster movies and comedies. So that's just kind of another Photoshop assembly technique. For C-Lab, for fun, we want to look at Kazakhstan. So we did. At that time, it was the fastest growing nation in the world in terms of output of buildings, because it was recently oil was recently discovered there, and investment by multinationals were taking place. So this is the capital of Kazakhstan. It's called Almaty, and it's officially the coldest capital of any nation. It gets down to minus 60 Celsius in the wintertime. But instead of looking at the kind of typical explosion of urban growth, we want to look at other things about Kazakhstan culture. So we went around to unexpected places, or in our minds, places that would be off the beaten track in terms of how you research a city. So we just went to different schools and took inspiration from there. So like, for example, the fascination with the diagonal. Like, why is everything on a diagonal in here? It's not like the artwork is diagonally based. Or that the fonts would be like obsessed with diagonals to the point where the detailing of all the fonts would be diagonally oriented. Or even when there would be repairs that would be needed to floors, that the diagonal would be respected. We looked at gold. There's all kinds of shades of gold in Kazakhstan. We also looked at things that were properly architectural. So it gets down to minus 60 Celsius. It also gets up to plus 45 Celsius in the summertime. And so, as you know, when you have those kinds of extreme weather conditions going on while you're doing new cities, that there are lots of problems that are bound to happen in terms of the detailing. So this is a photo actually of a recent building. It's not a historic building. This is the newly completed Ministry of Culture. So after they completed it, all the windows popped out. This is Ministry of Finance. Here's some of the details of it, just the kind of expansion that takes place. Also, the footprint of Kazakhstan is the size of Western Europe. It's humongous. It's one of the largest countries by area in the world. But it's also one of the least dense. So I think Western Europe has something like 275 million people. In Kazakhstan, there are only 15 million. So you can kind of do the numbers in terms of the land area per capita for individuals. And I think for them, the fact that you would have this massive building boom in a place where you're accustomed to wide open spaces produced this shock. And one of the kind of results of the shock was an obsession with the miniature. So with all of these models that you have of these urban plans, they have crazy little miniature details in it, which is one of the things that we also documented there. To the point where this model is part of a 1-to-200 model of the capital. So the model itself is way beyond the width of this auditorium, And then, you know, someone's detailing the penthouse in one of the random development buildings there. So this is something that we then put into Volume magazine. This is the spread on the diagonal gold detail. And then at Columbia, we decided to put on an exhibition of it. So we had a projector mounted onto the top of this modern-day yurt that we projected down onto it, onto the floor. And so in a lot of ways, it wasn't really an idea of how you should plan, but really a cautionary tale of what not to do if you are going to plan to do new cities. And then the base itself was an ode to the current president of Kazakhstan. He was also the Soviet leader of Kazakhstan during the Soviet era, and then he's won every free election since then. The second to last election, he won because his opponent committed suicide. And then, funny enough, the most recent opponent also committed suicide. The last one by shooting himself twice in the head and once in the heart. So, like, you know, very committed to his personal death. So yeah, you know, we do photography, we do illustrations, and even the things that we do that, you know, become, you know, semi three-dimensional are all kind of like graphic or close to being 2D. So, for example, we did this one thing in Volume on gum, basically. It was just sort of an essay on urban gum. And I mean, the reason why we did it was that we wanted to try to figure out a way where we could talk about the differences between Class A commercial space in New York and other types of commercial space in New York, and just what the differences were in the quality of it. And we couldn't get into a lot of the offices, as you could imagine. So one thing we could do is look at the front of buildings. And even with Class A buildings, they've got gum problems. This is Lever House, right? So it's one of the, you know, most expensive, if not the most expensive building to lease commercial space. This is AT&T. The affliction of gum isn't just restricted to commercial space. This is the UN, and this is Empire State Building. And so what we wanted to do was to talk about the fact that, the gum is a good indication of the fact that maintenance in New York is something, even with good buildings, that has to be understood to be a challenge. So this is a building we didn't do, but we were asked to do something for the opening of this building. And so what we proposed to them was to do a preemptive strike because you know, the building's so beautiful and pristine that there's no way that the front of the sidewalk is going to stay clean. And if it gets dirty, it's only going to make the Sana building look not so good. So what we proposed to them was to do a piece about gum. And you know, you've probably heard one of your parents say, "Look, if you have to drive late at night and you're sleepy, I mean, it's better if you don't drive. But if you have to drive, chew some gum because it'll keep you awake," which I think is true. You know, actually. But what we did was, you know, we found out that you know there is a kind of brain activation if you chew. And so what we proposed to the New Museum was that they should put a graphic of gum on their sidewalk before the real gum begins to dirty up the sidewalk. And the idea was that you would do these gum pieces that would be scaled proportionally to represent the effect, the effect on your brain of particular drugs. So for example, you know, this is the if this is the real scale of chewing gum, if you take nicotine gum, you get a little bit more of a buzz, and with Coca-Cola a bit more, with Speedballs and Mountain Dews and cocaine, larger ones. So this was a sort of representation of the size of the equivalent amount of gum you would have to chew to get the same brain effect as these other things. And they, you know, said no, that they didn't want to do this as a project. But what they did end up liking, and what we did do was this thing that that Dagmar mentioned called Donor Hall. And what it is a look at the, it's not a donor hall for the museum. It's not a list of all the people in the New Museum who've given to the New Museum. Rather, it's the people in general around the world who give to art and culture. And so it's broken down into different categories: religion, finance, individuals, foundations, commercial corporations. And then we've just looked at major donors in each of these categories, and then we represented it through pie charts. And then what we did was we put images of pies and other pie-shaped foods underneath it. So here's a pizza. Here's a Greek cheese, ramen, and a hamburger. And then here's the communication category, nations. Here's the sushi to represent energy. And so this is the space in the New Museum where it's located. And then if you look more closely at the images, they're not just images that are just straight photographs. Each of the images are made up of a mini text. So this is like a 5-point mini text. That's a collection of different philosophies of giving from Aristotle and Plato to Oprah Winfrey. And then after we did that installation for them, we wanted to just look at what is the nature of giving during a crisis? Like, when the economy dips, is it also the case that giving drops? And so we proposed to them that we would do a book and look at giving more generally. And so we did this book called World of Giving, and we did everything from just listed types of things that are given as gifts. We also looked at just the basic human interaction and dynamic of giving, like why one person gives to another, and the feedback mechanism that happens when people give one to another. We also looked at the fact that a lot of giving is driven by self-interest rather than altruism. And one of the things that we want to point out is that in the long run, that may not be a bad thing. That any kind of giving is a thing that might potentially be positive. So part of the book is talking about the fact that motivations for giving that sometimes are not seen as positive could very well be. We also looked at it on a global scale, when one individual wants to give to another individual on the other side of the world, how does that just happen? And what are the different organizations that are involved? So if a person here in one country wants to give to a person here, we mapped out the directions that kind of giving can take place through government, organizations, multilaterals, NGOs, and whatnot. And this I think, is the only map of this type that exists that we never found one by any other organization. We looked at different kinds of giving professionals. So we did different features. So this is one on the American nun and the conflicts that American nuns have had with the Vatican in terms of the fact that they're much more proactive because they don't stay within the confines of church properties, that as a type of, pedagogical logic, what they do is they go into cities and work with people in cities, and this has created a lot of conflict with the central church. We looked at aid architecture, just everything that the UN advises that are used as part of an infrastructure of assistance. We also do things like diagrams. This is a thing that we did for the leaks issue of Volume. And what it is that the radius of each of these circles demonstrates the geographical extent of each of these different leaks on a comparative basis. And then the magenta dots represents each of the casualties related to these environmental leaks. This is a thing that we did for the power issue also. It's on the number of extraordinary renditions the CIA did. And so the number of trips is the index of the radius of these circles. This is an urban study that we did on hedge funds, and the thing, you know, more or less that created the crisis. And the thing that was interesting to us was that in the 80s in New York, when the investment banking boom happened, you could just see how the city was changing because you saw people spending money everywhere. Like when you went to restaurants, you saw conspicuous consumption. And the same thing with the tech boom in the late 90s and early 2000s, that the city again exploded in terms of seeing people very affluent spending money. And the weird thing was with the hedge fund boom, that wasn't really the case. It wasn't that if you went out that suddenly there was an explosion of wealth that you saw. And so what we wanted to do is to figure out where that money was going and or what was that money, how does it work, how does it impact the city. So like we just took a random area of Manhattan, Midtown, and just looked at the number of alternative management companies that are out there and what they do. And so we found out that they have a lot of money. I mean, like, you know, like these are kind of boutique operations and they all have between $5 and $15 billion operating. So we kind of looked more closely and it happens to be the case that there is a lot more money, or there was a lot more money being exchanged during the last boom. So that in terms of the investment banking boom in the 80s, the compensation that the people were making then was about this amount. The people in the tech boom were making about this amount. And then this is what hedge fund managers were making comparatively to those guys in terms of their annual take home. To the extent that the top seven hedge fund managers in 2007 were making more money than all of the Fortune 500 CEOs combined. So we wanted to look at it on an architecture level just to see what goes on in those offices. And we mapped out the assets under management against the amount of office space that they lease. So at the red and the yellow bars represent hedge funds and alternative management asset companies, whereas the blue bars represent traditional full-service banks like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. So for Goldman Sachs, for each square foot of office space that they rent, they generate about $75,000, they have about $75,000 in assets. Whereas with these hedge funds, they have about $450,000 per square foot in assets. For each employee that they have, this is the amount of money they have in assets. So $120 to $130 million per employee compared to Morgan Stanley, which is about $17 million. So these are lean, mean machines, these companies. And what we wanted to do was to look at the way that they occupy space in New York. And with a lot of them, they generally don't need a lot of space. It's not like they need an entire building. That many of them can fit onto one floor or take up one full floor of a skyscraper, but that's about it. And we thought it was interesting then that if the ultimate typology of Manhattan is a skyscraper, because it is a thing that is consistent with the logic of real estate development, that you try to optimize the amount of lease revenue that you have per square foot of land in New York by repeating the floor plate over and over again, that the hedge fund was a thing that was consonant with that in the sense that in terms of being a lean, mean machine, incredibly efficient in terms of the money that it raised, that being inside of skyscrapers made all the sense in the world. They also happen to gravitate towards SOM 50s vintage buildings done by Gordon Bunshaft. So we renamed Gordon Bunshaft Gordon Fundshaft. This is a study that we did for volume because, you know, in the last 10 years, so many people are metaphorically called architects, like the architect of an economic plan or the architect of a political policy. And we wanted to know if there are times when the metaphor applies to the person where the person is, in fact, operating like an architect. So Richard Holbrooke is often termed the architect of the Dayton Peace Accord. Yeah, he's the guy that brokered peace in the Balkans. And what we want to say is that what Richard Holbrooke did is a lot like what architects and urban planners do. In negotiating between the three parties to create peace in the region, the way that the borders were determined and who would get different resources is precisely what architects do on a planning level. Historically speaking, as long as borders are complicated in their geometry, or typically speaking, when borders are complicated in their geometry, it tends to result in peace. If the borders between countries are very straight, conflict arises in the future. And so one of the things he did was that in negotiating the border between the three parties, he made it as zigzaggy as possible. He also was the person who decided who would get resources, so who would get water and who wouldn't get water. He decided who would get infrastructure, where the major roads would go, and who they would belong to, all things that we want to map out as part of this thing. He also designed the space of negotiations. He decided where the negotiations were going to be and where people would be housed. So his ideas was that he would have the Bosnians, the Serbs, and the Croats all in a single space with the U.S. as people that would broker communication between the two and leaving the Europeans outside of it. He also designed the negotiation table, the dimensions of it, who would sit at it, and who would sit at the periphery, where the flags would be located, and where the photographers would be located. And one of the reasons why he did this was that he's kind of a fan of history, and one of the things that was important to him was that with the Vietnam War, that 4 months was spent designing the table for the Paris Peace Treaty while the war went on. And so what he wanted to do was just make the table and get the thing going. And then this is the photo op of the signing of the agreement. This is a thing that we did for our office that also has to do with urbanism, but of a different sort. It was for an exhibition. The thing that's really impressive about the Hollywood sign is that it is in Los Angeles an urban landmark. And as an urban landmark, it's increased the value of the property around it. Which is strange because it doesn't do anything. It's not like your view is any better, by having the sign there, or there isn't anything about the property in that area that's better because the sign is there. It's just a thing where this area has raised in real estate value because of the presence of the sign, even though the sign, in terms of urban design or any other kind of urban effect, is little. Our idea was that, it's done its job, it's done a good job, it's increased value in that area. And now, could it be a thing where it increases the value of property in other places in LA? So one idea we had was to lease the letters out to different parts of LA that could use economic revitalization, and that these different areas could rent out the letters based upon their budgets. One letter, two letter, three letters, depending on what they could afford, so that places like Koreatown or Baldwin Heights might also have an object that would increase its value. These are things that are still kind of like photo 2D. Here's some things that are more 3D. This was an exhibition at the Walker that we were invited to was on suburbia. And so our proposal was that the best way to understand suburbia is to represent its trash. And we found out while doing this exhibition that suburbanites in major cities tend to vote for green issues. They're pro-environmental. They also tend to use twice as much water as their urban counterparts and generate three times as much trash as their urban counterparts. So even though in mind, in spirit, they're pro-environmental, in practice, they aren't. And so this was a series of trash cans that we did that described the consumption of resources in suburbia, using the suburban trash can as the artifact, as well as doing illustrations, like we did a mandala to contemplate consumption with a Slurpee in the middle. And then different deities to the different kinds of waste products that kind of became popular at the same time that environmental issues became popular. And then this is the installation. Another thing that is still more 2D than 3D is a thing that we did for what used to be the DIA Art Foundation in New York. During the economic downturn, the DIA moved out of the building, and the building was empty for about a year. Like a really smart art gallerist approached the landowner and said, look, your building is not being used. Let us use it for exhibitions for a year. Don't charge us rent. And at least that way, the building will continue to get exposure. And who knows, maybe somebody will lease it in the future. And on the rooftop of the DIA was this really beautiful Dan Graham pavilion, which the DIA disassembled. And so this art organization, X Initiative, asked us to do a temporary roof garden up there. That would be open during the summer. And we couldn't afford to do a pool, so we proposed to use pool noodles instead. So we designed a rooftop seating area using pool noodles. So they have film screenings and lectures and things like that there. We used 16,000 pieces of pool noodles. And then we used jigs to assemble them to create a topography. 30 people worked 2 weeks in order to produce this. So here's some, it's great. We kind of found a niche in architecture, you know, being whatever, paper architects, of doing like really fun exhibition projects that make no money whatsoever. Which is, you know, fine if that's our destiny for now. And on the other hand, we do urban plans, and we haven't really done a lot in between. So, our projects are either 3,000 square feet or 30 million square feet. This is a master plan proposal for a city in South Korea. And what we proposed with the museum and the mayor's office was to do a master plan of four different architects of a region of the city. And what we said was that, and so this is the building that we proposed as part of the master plan. And what we told them was, we'll do this master plan, we'll do these drawings, and give us money for an exhibition at the museum to show the plans and the models. And so we used the model budget to create scaled versions of all the buildings, and we wanted the models to be multifunctional. So each of the models is a representation of our building proposal, and at the same time is a functional piece of the museum interior. So our building we transformed into the ticket kiosk of the museum, which is a permanent piece for the museum. This is a piece that we did in Rome, a pavilion for the largest public hospital there, the oldest one, Policlinico, which was really interesting to do because it's a 19th century hospital, and as a 19th century hospital, it's distributed and laid out more like a campus than the hospitals that you and I know as medical centers. So each building is a building that's specific to a given kind of ailment or disease. So there'll be a building for lung disease, a building for children, a building for cancer, et cetera. And so what we proposed for this was to do a pavilion that would serve as a central waiting room for the hospital. And the hospital administrators thought, oh, this would be really great because it means that patients and doctors can all go someplace where they can smoke. So this would be this place where people would gather and socialize. And so it's at the center of the hospital, It was intended as a temporary structure, you know, obviously because in Rome it's so difficult to get anything built permanently. And even with temporary structures, it requires that a state archaeologist comes out, makes sure that there's no ruins on your site, and if there are, it can stop construction or radically modify what you can do. In our case, there were archaeological findings that were discovered, and so with these, we had to make foundations that were only 18 inches deep. And then they all it's run on PV power from the roofs of these things. And so this was meant to be up for 4 months, and in a kind of mastery of brinksmanship and political savvy, you know, the hospital administrators said, okay, well, it was supposed to be temporary, but we're going to make it permanent. And they said they defied any politician that would come and take down a temporary structure within a museum, within a hospital. And so for them, it was like a super smart thing, and you know, that they would get then a permanent waiting room on a under the guise of a temporary pavilion. So this was a thing that was accidentally like a permanent commission of ours, even though it was designed to be temporary. The worrisome thing, though, about doing temporary pavilions is that there is always a time limit on these things. And even though this one is going to be up for a while, now we're getting asked to do temporary things that are being up for shorter and shorter amounts of time. So the storefront asked us if we would do a pavilion that would be up for just 3 hours. And so it's kind of crazy that you have to design something that you propose that you know you really love, but also design its demise and have an execution plan for how it's going to be taken away. It was for an exhibition called Landscapes of Quarantine, and so it was about how germs, airborne germs, potentially spread from one place to another. And it was great to do it at the storefront because of the fact that it has those beautiful doors, gallery doors there. So for the show, what we did was we proposed to quarantine the storefront, if you will, that we would manage the air inside the space during the opening of the exhibition. So what we proposed was a thing that we called suck and blow. One structure that would suck the air out of the gallery space, and another one that would blow the air in. So this is suck, and that's blow. I think the interesting or fun thing about it was that it was intended to be kind of a guerrilla installation, and so the challenge was to actually install it before the police would come and ask for a permit. And because it wasn't permitted, the risk was that it would have to come down if they saw it. It turned out that we were so organized by the way we did this that the police came by and congratulated us on how organized that we were being, and just assumed that we had a permit because things were going so smoothly. But then on the other hand, you know, the way that we were able to do this on time and on budget was that that the guy who did all the steel work gave us a price that included coming and cutting up the steel and then using the steel himself for other projects. So at 10:30 that night, you know, the guy comes in a truck and a power saw and just starts cutting up the pieces on the street and took it off and then sold the frames to somebody else. This is a project that we did for the Whitney. It was part of the last Whitney Biennial. You know, it was great to be able to do a project in the Breuer space and to deal with the setback condition here and with the double height area on the interior. It was a good moment because the restaurant that currently is inside the space didn't get its lease renewed, the museum decided that they wanted to have a new restaurant inside of there. And in between the new restaurant, which will open next year, and the opening of the biennial, they asked us to do a temporary restaurant in the space. And it was great. So we, you know, we just went in there one day and they said, hey, we want you to do a restaurant. Can you come back in a week with some ideas for a restaurant? And we showed up the next week and the restaurateur guy was there. His name is Danny Meyer. So we showed him the proposal and we said, look, we don't know anything about restaurants. We don't know, you know, like how to organize them and what the spacing should be, what the density should be, what the circulation patterns will be. So we're just going to do a proposal that really doesn't touch the floor at all. And Danny is one of these guys who kind of typifies successful American businessmen who are all about positive reinforcement. And so after the presentation, he said, I love your design. I think it's really, really beautiful. It's going to be a great, great restaurant. I don't want you to do something that just doesn't touch the space. I want you to do something that is all about the restaurant. I want you to come up with the menu. I want you to do like, you know, lay out the design of the tables, blah, blah, blah. And we said, so, okay, you know, we'll, give us a week. And we came back in a week and we proposed to him this thing. And we proposed to him a menu of that would consist of sandwiches. And, you know, after the meeting, he said, I think it's a great idea. That's amazing, because I was thinking sandwiches too. It got off to a good start. So this is what we proposed, are these hanging elements that would occupy the double height space. Then we did we refurbished some of the tables there, came up with new chairs, and then came up with the menu. We worked on the menu with him and decided what kinds of foods and stuff would be on it. These structures occupy the double height space along the entry of the museum on Madison as part of a facade, if you will, of that space. And this is it on the first floor, the view that you see on the ground floor of it. Then the views from the lower floor. And it was during this project that I was thinking, you know, I was talking with people in our office, and it turns out that, you know, not only do we do more or less paper architecture, things that are not buildings, but that about half the things that we've done hang rather than having foundations. You know, that we're kind of doing architecture, but we're doing things that defy what you normally do in architecture in many ways. But I don't think of those as oppositions necessarily, but things that are two different poles of the same issue that we want to reconcile or have be part of our architectural practice. So things that you typically think of as being contradictory to one another, we want to have as being part of our repertoire of things that we do. So whether it's hanging versus using foundations, whether it's temporality versus permanence, whether it's using graphics versus doing things that are volumetric, whether they're things that produce insight versus through analysis, versus propositions and buildings. Those are things that we as paper architects, if you will, want to unfold and present to you as a range of possibilities rather than things that are polar opposites from one another in the way in which practices are formed. And that the range of things that we do attempt to work both sides of those dualities in terms of the propositions that we make. So, like, even things like this, you know, that there is an effort to be graphic with them, to be identifiable as figures, graphic in terms of the contrast, but that there are also construction things that are involved in it. So to do these two prototypes, we used the same fiberglass shell, and in order to fabricate these in time, it was actually cheaper to make these in California rather than in New York and ship them across the country. So these things are divided up into thirds so that they fit onto a transportation truck in order to be Brought across the country, and that the graphic elements, like the color things, also function as the structural elements of the installation. So we just use ripstop nylon as a thing that supports the shell below. But nevertheless, besides doing things that are three-dimensional and volumetric, we also did things that were part of this that were graphic or of a furniture scale. So we did the bars, we did the chairs. These are chairs that they're just the plastic stackable chairs, and then we got the upholsterer who did the brasserie, Delicious Cavideo upholstery, to do these seat covers, and then all combined, this thing retails for $35. We did T-shirts. The place is called Sandwiched, so we took an image of a sandwich and then just reversed it out on the front and back. And then the thing that like I'm really proud of is that we also did the order cards for the menu. So like, and then you take a number back to the seat before they give you the food. And we use this as a opportunity to do a Whitney Museum of American Art building collection of materials. So we just sampled all of the different materials in the Breuer building. And on these cards, the front has the front face of the material, and then the back has the back face of the material. The acoustical ceiling, these really beautiful doors that were actually precede the Breuer building, some of the upholstery from the old restaurant, and whatnot. So I think, you know, for us, doing things like these little cards has as much reward as doing things like master plans. And with each of these things, hopefully there's insight into the material reality of the places that we're dealing with that comes across. So thank you.